It is 7:30, time once again for a community forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Lynn Dodson, who is president of the Seattle Community Colleges Federation of Teachers. She's also co-chair with Washington State Jobs with Justice, and Paul Bigman, who is an organizer with the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, and he is also with Jobs with Justice. And I want to thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks,
good morning.
Mike.
Let's start out, and I'll ask you, what is Jobs with Justice?
Well, Jobs with Justice is a coalition of labor, faith, community, youth organizations working, fighting for social justice in our communities and economic justice. We have about 120 member organizations that set policy and about 5,000 individuals who are in our database and that we call on for actions. We're an activist organization that works for economic and social justice.
And I see you guys have a lot of events that happen here locally, as well as there's one coming up on the 10th next week.
That's right. The International Human Rights Day, we have an event at the Federal Building at 11:30 that's to rally for, to get back the right to organize and bargain collectively. We also support organizations that are in struggles and support one another's organizations and have a workers' rights board that hears the stories of workers that are going through struggles in their work.
Well, and obviously one of the key structures for defending workers' rights is the union. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can give us a sense of the state of U.S. unions. Where are we today, and are we better off than we were, 50 years ago?
Labor union representation in this country peaked a little while after World War II in the early 1950s when 35% of workers in this country had union representation. And at that time, there were changes in labor laws, principally the passage of what's called the Taft-Hartley Act, which were designed to weaken unions, and they were quite successful. And since the early 50s, there's been a steady decline in the proportion of workers in this country have union representation, so that today only 13% of U.S. workers have union representation, and in the private sector, only 9%. And part of what's happened in addition to the changes in labor laws, of course, has been a dramatic change in the U.S. economy as the globalization forces and globalization treaties which the U.S. has signed have encouraged the export of manufacturing jobs, labor's traditional base. A lot of the sectors of the economy, which used to be heavily union, barely exist.
It's important to point out, I think, too, that the benefits of unionization at this point, 53% of American workers want to be in unions. They would vote for a union if they could, but only 13% of workers are in unions. And it's not too much of a stretch to see why people would want to be in unions. Wages are 26% higher for union members. And for women and African Americans and Latino workers, that wage increase is even more dramatic. Women who are in labor unions earn 31% more than women who aren't. African American labor union members earn 29% more than African Americans who aren't. And Latino workers earn 53% more when they're in labor unions than when they're not. It's also that it's not only individuals who get these advantages. Healthcare is another one. 75% of union members have health care compared to only 49% of non-union members. But it's also the social safety net strengthened. In strong union states, there's also more money for education, higher unemployment benefits, higher workers' comp benefits. There's a stronger safety net for strong union states compared to weak union states.
Would Washington State be considered strong or weak?
Washington is one of the highest union density rates in the country. It's one of the handful of states where still 20% of the workforce or more has union representation. And that's in part due to the strength of organized labor on the waterfront and at Boeing in the Puget Sound area. We have the highest average union wages in the country in Seattle. And that's a large part of why the average wage generally in Seattle-Tacoma area and in Washington as a whole is much higher than for most of the country. Mm. I mean, consistently all of the states that have the relatively high union rates like New York, Michigan, Alaska, Hawaii, all have much higher average incomes.
Although even in Washington State, union density has declined dramatically in the last 20 years also.
And again, that is because of things like, well, Taft-Hartley, that would have happened, what, 20 years before, 40 years ago, but...
Partly because of that, partly because of what Paul mentioned with the movement of manufacturing jobs out of the area, outsourcing, that's had an impact. Did you want to say something about...
Well, and look, because of the changes in the law, one of the things that's happened is that employers have become increasingly emboldened as they can see that not only the laws have been weakened, but that enforcement of the laws has been weakened even more than the laws themselves. Right. And as a consequence, what you find is that now when workers try to organize, more than 92% of employers have mandatory anti-union presentations. Better than 3 out of 4 employers force workers to attend one-on-one sessions where their supervisors pound on them not to support unions. In fact, just over half of employers in union organizing drives in the private sector threaten to close the plant if workers organize, which of course is illegal to make the threat, much less to do it. When there are immigrant workers in the workforce, which increasingly is the case, over half of employers in union organizing drives threaten to call in the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which is essentially a terror campaign. In 1 out of 4 union organizing drives, a worker involved in organizing is fired for union activity. In about 18% of workers who are actively involved in union organizing drives end up being fired and getting their jobs back through the weak labor laws we've got.
We need to point out, this is really particularly outrageous. The right to organize is a human right under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The United States signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, and that includes the right to organize. But this right is being... We're an outlaw nation, really, when it comes to how we treat workers who try to organize. We don't... If these kinds of infringements were placed on general free speech rights, we would be angry. We would see citizens out in the street a lot more. But when workers try to organize, it's primarily met with silence by citizens, and that has to change in order for us to be able to exercise this right. We wanted to talk some about the particular incidences that have happened in our own city, because it's not... There's one problem is the laws and the weak enforcement of them. Another problem is the advantage that employers take of these weak laws to do this intimidation. Paul gave you some of the overall statistics, but we were at a workers' rights board hearing the other night, and we heard very specific examples of employers' outrageous techniques that they use to fire workers or to get rid of workers to prevent union organizing.
And to give you a few examples, with very specific examples, the American Phoenix, the largest seafood processor, floating seafood processor on the West Coast, back in January had 200 workers come on board to work on this floating processor, that's floating seafood processing. And the workers signed up for the normal 16 hours a day, 7 days a week work. Once they got on board and underway, the employer told them that they would have to work 16 and a half hours, 7 days a week. When the workers protested, and when I say protested, there was no work stoppage of any sort. They simply protested the increase. The employer took 25 of the 200 workers, cut their pay, took them off the ship in the Aleutian Islands, sent them home to Seattle, deducting the cost of the airfare from their final paycheck. When the workers went to the National Labor Relations Board, the federal agency that's theoretically designed to protect workers' rights, to complain about this, the employer charged these floating factory workers with mutiny. We had a situation with Black Diamond Construction Company, a Canadian-owned construction company in this area, where workers tried to organize, and the company put in a false list to the National Labor Relations Board of who was eligible to vote, so that although a majority of workers had actually indicated support for the union, the National Labor Relations Board refused to schedule an election because unions aren't entitled to see the list of what the employer claims are eligible voters. We had testimony about the Provident Hospital system run by the Catholic Church, which has a theoretical commitment to human rights and to labor rights. But when the workers at the hospital have tried to organize, most recently at St. Joseph's down in Olympia, they bring in high-priced union busters, put out videos that they send to each individual worker, and coerce and threaten the workers. And then we have some immigrant factory workers at El Dorado Stone in Carnation, Washington, where they did things like changing the work rules to deny workers in a rubber foam plant the right to get cold water and fresh air during their workday, resulted in one worker passing out, another having a stroke. They changed the rules back as soon as the election was over. And when the union went to the National Labor Relations Board, they said, well, we think the employer violated people's rights. We think they broke the law, but it was we're not going to do anything about it. We're going to issue what's called a merit dismissal. And one of the grounds for that is that it was of limited duration. You can imagine what would happen if you went into court for violating other laws and said, well, yes, Judge, I beat a guy and I stomped him in the face, but I stopped after a while. And you would hardly find the judge saying, oh, well, as long as you stop, that's okay.
We like to, if we're thinking about this as, well, these are a few really bad employers, that's not the case. This is a culture of acceptance of denying people the right to organize. Providence is a good example. This is a part of the Catholic Church, just a social justice organization, and yet they feel emboldened to use precious healthcare dollars to hire consultants to keep their nurses and their med techs from organizing. One-on-one meetings telling people that why they shouldn't join the union. The union doesn't have the same right to meet during the work time with the employees. It would be something akin to if you're going to vote for a presidential candidate, one of them has to stand on the border of Canada and hand out leaflets, and the other one is beamed into your living room automatically, and you must watch. That's what it's very similar to.
Has there been a concerted effort by big business to weaken the National Labor Relations Board? How is that board even made up? Is that elected?
There are seven people who are appointed by the president, so that although generally it's been a downhill slope, there's some fluctuations. When relatively labor-friendly administrations are in power, the labor board becomes a little less hostile to workers' rights. Under, for example, Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, the appointees become extremely anti-union. As a recent example of a decision affecting many workers in this country, historically, undocumented workers, that is, people here without papers, have had labor rights on the job, so that employers can't use immigration law as a club over workers trying to organize. Just in the last couple of years, in a case called Hoffman Plastics, it was ruled that, no, you can actually get away with violating labor laws for undocumented workers with no penalties, and if you get caught on violating the labor laws and can demonstrate that the workers are here without papers, instead of the minor penalties that go against an employer, the workers just ended up being deported. And when I say minor penalties, folks should understand that for most labor law violations, the most serious penalty that the labor board hands out is the employer has to post a piece of paper on a bulletin board at the workplace saying, gosh, we violated the law. We're sorry.
Talk a bit about what unions have brought our society in the past. I think a lot of people are still unaware of the many benefits that unions have brought beyond just, you know, good paying jobs.
Well, we have a 40-hour week. Weekends, labor movement brought us a weekend. Also, child labor laws are a result of labor unions work. Paul, do you want to?
Social Security, both retirement and disability, unemployment compensation. The strength of the labor movement was absolutely essential for passage of almost every piece of civil rights legislation in the 20th century, including laws prohibiting discrimination on the basis of race and ethnicity, including passage of laws prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sex. The In addition to the legislation that we're talking about, by raising the bar, the labor movement helps to set standards which forces even non-union employers to provide things which in the past no workers had. And we take these things for granted now, but things like paid vacation, paid holiday, health insurance, even though we're losing the battle on that one in a way, none of these things used to be provided to workers. They were won by hard-fought battles within the labor movement, and once union employers started providing these benefits, non-union employers had to provide them to at least some degree in order to compete for the labor.
Although it's still astounding how few do, and how few people know the different. Most, I've been talking with a lot of students lately in the colleges, and most students don't realize that an employer can fire a good employee at will for no cause. There is nothing to protect a worker from being fired unless you have a union contract that says you have to be fired. There must be a process. There has to be cause to lose your job. Sick leave, vacation. I talked to some students the other day and I asked them what were the minimum requirements of a job. Most said fairly basic, a living wage, health care, sick leave. There is no requirement. A minimum wage is not a living wage. In Seattle, $7 is about the minimum wage. You need $14 to live in this area per hour. I asked the students if they would go individually to their employer and ask them, well, I need this money. I need a living wage. I need health insurance. And all of them realized that individually they couldn't do that. They would be likely to lose their job or be laughed out of the office. But collectively, they can ask for those really basic, not unreasonable things. A living wage is not an unreasonable thing to expect from a job. Healthcare is not an unreasonable thing to expect. Sick leave is not unreasonable to expect from your job. And yet, many employers, don't have any of these.
And in fact, talking about the minimum wage here, I think a lot of people in Washington tend to forget. Because of the strength of the labor movement in putting together and helping to pass a state minimum wage law in this state, much higher than the national, we have a minimum wage here of $7.05. The federal minimum wage is $5.35 an hour. And in a lot of states, including ones with costs of living just as high as Washington's, that $5.35 minimum wage is still the standard.
So it seems that we have quite a hurdle here. If we've got 53% of people wanting unions and we're only at 13% of those out there actually being in one, what do you see as solutions here that people on the grassroots level can implement? Because it doesn't sound like anything's coming from the top down.
Well, I think there are a few things that have to happen. Folks who are not members of unions and not in a position to pressure their own unions to take more actions, I think what we need is for there to be more public pressure on employers to recognize that we have community standards, that our communities will not tolerate this kind of behavior towards workers in our communities. We need more public pressure on public officials to do what they can to set standards. And for example, one of the things that's coming out of the Workers' Rights Board hearing the other day is that Representative Steve Conway, who was one of the panelists at that hearing and who is chair of the House Commerce and Labor Committee in the Washington State Legislature, has indicated that he's going to study introducing some legislation barring employers who violate workers' rights and are found guilty of breaking the law on workers' rights, barring them from getting public contracts. That would be a big step forward. And we need folks, frankly, I mean, this is Jobs with Justice's philosophy, we need folks out on the streets. We don't just need them calling up legislators or dropping them letters, but we need them being out there with us at the factory gates, at the hospitals, at the employers, saying, you know, our community won't tolerate you're violating workers' rights, firing people for standing up for themselves, discriminating against them, threatening them, threatening to move the workplace to another area. And we need to make it clear that this community does have standards on workers' rights.
And we have to be sure to remember that any right, the right to organize, is intricately linked to our other rights. We don't have a right of freedom of speech or right of association if that right doesn't extend to the workplace. We can't say, yes, we have the right of free speech, but we leave that right behind as soon as we walk into our workplace. Or we have the right to join any organization we want until we step into our workplace, and then we don't have the right any longer to do that. It is going to take... If every union member in this state or even in this country was outraged by this and stood up and did something, that still wouldn't be enough. We need members of the public who are not yet in unions to also stand up and say that it's not right. It's not right to treat workers this way.
Yeah, I have a friend who pointed out that how is it that we got to the point where, you know, the one place we spend the most time in our lives, maybe with the exception of sleeping, but based on what your story is about, how some people run their company, that's not true. how there is an absolute lack of democracy, you know, for a supposed democratic country. So,
well, we've also seen incredible differences in the wage gap in this country. As union density has declined, the wage gap has also increased. So that now, instead of having, well, Canada, the top CEOs make 11% more than entry-level workers. In the United States, it's the difference is anywhere, depending on the statistics here, from 400 times to, for the very top CEOs, the top 100 CEOs in the Fortune 500, they make 1,000 times what entry-level workers do. There's only so many houses, I suppose, that somebody can buy, one person with all that wealth. The strength of our economy also comes from many more people having enough money to purchase goods, to save money, to live well.
Yeah, and talking about minimum wages, with the weakening of the labor movement, if during the decade of the 90s the minimum wage had gone up at the same rate as the increase for average CEO pay, the minimum wage today would be over $25 an hour. If the average production worker's wage had gone up at the same rate as the average CEO pay, the average wage for workers in this country would be $120,000-some-odd a year, and I don't think many of us make that much.
How does the U.S. compare to other industrial nations in terms of unions?
It's got one of the lowest unionization rates of any industrial country in the world, in part because we have such weak labor laws. And that explains what Lynn was talking about with the increasing disparity in the income distribution in this country.
And yet, a lot of the jobs, we're seeing a lot of jobs being shipped overseas. I would assume that's to non-industrial countries.
Yes, yes. Increasingly, the jobs, which, you know, when I'm old enough to remember when people used to think that going to Japan meant low wages. That time is long past. Japanese automakers now make cars in the United States for export back to Japan to take advantage of our low-wage economy. But now jobs are being sent to countries with virtually no labor standards, virtually no environmental standards, and that, of course, is encouraged by treaties like NAFTA and the WTO and GATT and the proposed FTAA. What this does is, as we've seen most recently in the steel industry, is enable countries with lower standards as well as lower wages to challenge the U.S. if we try to protect what we've got here. And they call that protectionism. It is. It's protecting our standard of living. Obviously, as a labor movement, we are not saying that we don't want workers in those countries to have jobs. On the contrary, what we want to do is use internationalism to raise the standard of living for workers in other countries and work together with unions in those countries where they're legal to bring up the standard of living. The problem is, in many of those low-wage countries, for all practical purposes, workers have no real rights. Even in some of the more developed countries, for example, in Taiwan, at least on the books, going on strike is a capital offense.
In addition to nixing Taft-Hartley, it sounds like you'd be in support of doing away with the things like the WTO, the FTAA.
Well, we need fair trade laws, not just free trade. We also, most of the free trade policies have the free movement of corporations, but they don't have the free movement of workers from one country to another. So we do need to promote international worker solidarity. Also, there is legislation that's been proposed by Kennedy in currently that would make it easier for workers to organize and that would also increase the penalties to employers. This legislation, a legislative approach isn't going to solve the problem. This legislation doesn't stand a chance, I think, of passing under this administration, but it also isn't going to solve the problem because we currently have employers that break the law with impunity anyway. So we need to have a multi-pronged approach. We have to have legislation. Look at Taft-Hartley. Look at the Railway Act. We also need to have employers called out for their anti-worker practices and policies. And we need people in the streets, as Paul said, being active and standing up for workers' rights.
It should be clear that right now, an employer who is absolutely determined not to deal with the union can do it with impunity. It may cost a lot of money, but employers who really hate unions, take the most massive example, Walmart.
Yeah.
Walmart will spare no expense in stopping workers from having union representation. But not only spare no expense, they'll spare no effort. The one victory that workers have had in forming a union was at the meat department in one Walmart store in the state of Texas. Little tiny group of workers. In response to those workers winning union representation, Walmart eliminated the meat departments in five states so that nobody else could organize. And when we talk about globalization, there was just an article in this morning's paper. Walmart is not only the largest employer in the United States. As of yesterday, it is also the largest employer in Mexico. And part of their formula is what they claim is serving consumers by holding down costs, meaning they pay as little money as possible. They pay virtually no benefits. I mean, they on paper have a benefit policy. But in fact, if you talk to people in a small town where Walmart has come in, what you find is the benefits only go to full-time workers and almost nobody gets full-time work. They get fewer than 40 hours a week. They get no benefits. Walmart is forcing producers, even in underdeveloped countries, to constantly slash their costs. There was an article in the New York Times just in the past week that Walmart is putting out of business manufacturers in developing nations where they pay practically nothing because nobody can meet their standards on costs. And part of their policy is no unions, so that even in China, Walmart is being accused by the Chinese Trade Union Federation of violating Chinese labor laws for refusing to recognize and deal with unions in China.
And this is the wealthiest corporation in the world that's paying their employees about $7.50 an hour. Part of their justification was, well, they sell things for very little, so they can pay people very little, which is, if we think about it, what's the problem with that? It's bringing everyone's working and living standards down dramatically.
And it's a real change from an earlier major employer and a really right-wing guy, Henry Ford, who, when he started his automobile company, said, look, I want to make sure that my employees can afford to buy the product that they make.
Well, one of the things you recommend for people to do is get out in the streets, and you have an event coming up this Wednesday, I believe.
Right.
Can you tell us about that?
December 10th at the Federal Building. This is it's the start. It's a rally for workers' rights, regaining the right to organize, and it's a start. We can't have a rally and then go home and think that we've solved the problem. So we want people to come out to this rally and then continue activism, continue calling out employers, joining us in calling out employers who are violating workers' rights. Join us in trying to build back the workers' rights to organize. This is a Federal Building, 11:30 on Wednesday.
And this is part of a national day of actions. There will be rallies like this all over the country in I think, about 40 cities to kick off this campaign. That's the Jackson Federal Building at 2nd and Marion.
All right. And you're both with Jobs with Justice. Can you tell us how people can contact your organization?
Yeah, two ways. We have a website, wsjwj.org. And we also have phone number, 206. Uh-oh.
441. 4969.
Okay. Very good. All right. Well, unfortunately, with that, we're out of time. I want to thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much.
We've just been talking with Lynn Dodson, who is president of the Seattle Community Colleges Federation of Teachers, and Paul Bigman, who is an organizer with the International Longshore and Warehouse Union.